Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Stanford Daily Podcast. I'm Joy, and I am very excited to introduce a new series called Health Around the World. This series will primarily be focused on interviewing Stanford experts on topics such as global health, health disparities, and health equity. If you're interested in listening to different perspectives on modern-day healthcare, then keep on listening. Today, I'll be interviewing Dr. Clea Sarnquist on her experience within the field of global health. So if you could please introduce yourself, like who you are, what your career and research is centered around, and what your role is here at Stanford.
Yeah, so Clea Sarnquist, my training is in public health, so I have a master's in public health and a doctorate in public health, both. I've worked in global health for about 15 years and in sort of health disparities in HIV for longer than that. My role here is I'm a clinical associate professor in the School of Medicine, and I sit in pediatric in the infectious disease division within the Department of Pediatrics.
How did you get interested in global health? Was this something you became interested in med school or before that, or what kind of like shaped your trajectory to where you are now?
Yeah, it was something I was always interested in, just sort of based on some traveling as a kid and just sort of some vague understanding of the sort of inequities prevalent in global health. I thought about doing Peace Corps after college, did study abroad in college, and did work on a health-related sort of disparities equity project in Ecuador for that. Okay. Thought about doing Peace Corps and then ended up deciding to focus on health inequities in the U.S. instead of globally, and did the VISTA program, which is Volunteers in Service to America, which is a domestic Peace Corps that was created at the same time as Peace Corps. So I did that, and I worked at a school in East Salinas working with migrant children in that community. And then I went and did my master's, and then I moved to New York for a couple of years and worked in the HIV world, which there's a lot of inequities in that space as well in terms of the populations that have been disadvantaged often, people who end up infected with HIV. And that's true globally, but it's actually less true globally. It's very true in the US, especially at that time. But even now, it's, you know, especially populations who are intravenous drug using, et cetera. So, and then I came back here and did my doctorate and started working at Stanford again on health inequities and HIV inequities in the state of California and with the CDC nationally in the US. But then through the work here at Stanford, I had the opportunity to start working globally again a little bit and did that a little bit again and got excited about that. And still, so even now, I kind of go back and forth a little bit. A lot more of my work has been globally focused in the last 15 years, but I still do work on local projects sometimes. Certainly during COVID I did, many people did. And we're doing some sexual assault prevention work on campus as well now. Okay. So definitely not 100% globally focused.
I'm just wondering, how would you define global health? And why do you think it's important to learn about healthcare disparities around the world and also in the country that you live in?
Yeah, I guess I would define global health as the sort of study or participation or programming in kind of reducing inequities. Right. Outside of our own country instead of inside our own country. Not that everyone in it is necessarily doing the right thing or there to reduce inequities, but I would say that that's what it should be. One is we're all interconnected, and like honestly, like we've got to take care of the globe, and we see that in climate change, we see that in infectious diseases, or we're all going to have the major issues, right? So there's the sort of self-interest piece of it, and then there's the piece that I think brought me to it more originally, which is that the inequities globally, and this is not to downplay the inequities in this country because they're really bad and really important, but the inequities globally are so incredibly stark and they're so bad in so many places, and it sort of feels a little bit inexcusable, both in this country and, well, actually maybe more so within our own country, given that we really should have the resources to solve, or we do could have the resources to solve these issues if we had political will. And it, like fundamental inequities of things like education too, which then means that we have more expertise, which it shouldn't be how it is. But yeah, just the sort of level of inequity. And to be perfectly honest, the self-interested opportunity to work with lots of different kinds of people in lots of interesting different places and do a ton of like learning about different approaches and I mean, our sexual assault prevention work on campus actually grew out of, we were working in Kenya on sexual assault prevention. Okay. And then the Brock Turner case happened, and we thought, God, we really should be doing something in our own community. Right. Where we're focusing all this time and energy. And these were great projects, and I'm glad we did them, but that's how we got involved on campus work originally, like 7 or 8 years ago. So that was definitely, and to this day, all of the, not all of it, but there is a much stronger base of clever, innovative sexual assault prevention programming going on globally than there is in the U.S. So there's definitely also times, again, somewhat selfishly, right, where we can learn a lot from what's going on in other places. And I know we frequently do not pay attention to that, especially if there are other places that are lower, low, middle income countries that we kind of discount, when in fact we could be learning a lot.
And on that same note, I was wondering if we see maybe health policy or like governmental influence playing a part in global health in any way. Do you have any perspective on that?
I mean, unfortunately, like, it drives a huge piece of it, right? Like, I mean, not to get super political, but like the global gag rule around abortion, if your organization has anything to do with abortion, you can't get certain kinds of US funds, right? That is literally telling the rest of the world, like, how to run their country, right? Otherwise we won't help support them or their governments, regardless of what their ideological stance is. So yes, I mean, I think politics are a huge piece of it. You know, the whole reason non-governmental organizations, which we call nonprofits here, exist is to fill in places where the government either sort of, you know, in a good system, they would be filling in places where the government either can't or won't act, right? So that's not always what happens, but the good NGOs are specifically there to, you know, partner with the government and fill, and or if there's a dysfunctional government, fill in pieces that they can't or won't do. So yeah, I mean, politics plays a huge role, and I think we're all realizing more and more that if you're not doing some advocacy and policy briefs and trying to communicate both to the public and to policymakers, that you're probably not going to have as big of an effect as we might hope we can.
I know you mentioned earlier you work on child health, so I was wondering if you could kind of break down if there's any like social or economic determinants of health in children, and in your work, have you seen health disparities rise from that, like children in different regions of the world kind of being more susceptible to different diseases than others maybe?
Yeah, so all of our work basically is focused on children, but although a lot of it is on adolescents, even like youth, so getting in some cases into early 20s, although we have done newborn health work as well. But yeah, I mean, you know, the largest determinant of your lifespan is where you're born. And we see even in the U.S. that there's a sort of social determinants of health, right? You can be born in different zip codes in the same city and have like a 20-year, like, right, life disparities. So it's just, I think, worse when we go globally. Maybe not much worse, but in some places, certainly. And I don't know if you've seen like aerial photos of, and you can do this for the U.S. as well, again, but of like parts of like Johannesburg, et cetera, where you'll have like huge houses with swimming pools and like expansive lawns, literally on one side of a road, and then you'll have an informal settlement or slum on the other side of the road. And depending on which side of the road you're born on, your chances of making it to age 5 or age 18 or age 80 are like totally different, right? So just access to safe outdoor spaces for playing and walking and exercise, access to high quality food, like all of those social determinant pieces, access to high quality education, all of that you're going to be missing out on the other side of the road, literally. So, and like you said, certainly like more exposure to infectious diseases, to mosquitoes, to standing water, and then less access to healthcare, although we know the healthcare piece is sort of 15-20 to 50-ish% of people surviving, and the other 50-80% really is the social determinants. Right. So that makes a huge difference.
So in like your ideal world, how could, you know, healthcare systems better accommodate, you know, different populations in order to ensure equitable access to healthcare? Do you have any ideas?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing, you know, there's nice pockets of work in this space. One of the programs I love that we have here at Packard is if you have a hospitalized child now, and this is just in the last couple of years, you get a coupon if they order a meal in the hospital, which is paid for by insurance usually. There's a coupon on there that for $10, the caregiver with them can get a meal, and still $10, but that's a lot cheaper than, you know, and as you might imagine, the hospital cafeteria is not cheap, and they have to leave the bedside to go to the hospital cafeteria. And of course, if you get DoorDash or anything in the community here, it's all crazy expensive. So if you're a low-income family in the hospital with your child, like, you at least have the opportunity to get fed, because those, it turns out those caregivers just weren't eating. because it was so expensive and it was hard to get food. And that's a huge problem for everybody, including the care team, because they're much more likely to be snappy and cranky and upset. They're already in a very stressful situation. They have a hospitalized kid. And then they're much more likely to escalate poor behavior if they haven't eaten in a day or two, right? So anyway, so that's like, it's like little things like that, I think, that sometimes people, we forget that, like, it can actually be hard to get food, especially in an environment like this. So that can make a big, and that's just like an example of what can happen, like, in the hospital, certainly broadly. And we've seen some of this, like, starting to think about wrapping families around with all of those social, legal, housing services they might need, right? Because no matter how many times you treat the kid for pneumonia, if they are going back to some kind of really substandard bad housing situation and or malnourished or whatever, they're gonna keep coming back, right? So we're not gonna solve the problem without. So I think we're seeing a better job of coordination of services. In some places, in some places globally, they've done a lot better job of that for a long time, like especially where places that have always taken kind of community support into consideration more. And there's been, well, I don't know if there's more, but I think it, depending on the setting you're in, some of that may be culturally a little bit more built into the medical care model, but not always. I also think where you have fewer trained healthcare providers, you can't help but some of the community health workers and those kinds of things, where there's actually less availability to physicians, you may have somewhat more holistically oriented providers, which is not to say that's still not good, because you do need more trained healthcare providers, but it would be nice if we had more community health workers. Mm-hmm. That's another place we can learn from, because we do know, even like in the U.S., if you send a trained nurse or whatever, postpartum care provider out to houses, you get better mommy and baby outcomes in the first 6 months or year, and it's not particularly expensive or complicated, but it's just sort of not really built into our system and our insurance system.
So for anyone who might be listening that wants to pursue a career in global health, whether it be, politically or becoming a physician or a nurse or anything in the healthcare field, what advice could you give them? I know personally for me, you kind of have these ideas and you want to help solve all these global health crises and want to make an impact in that kind of realm, but it can sometimes feel unattainable at some times and kind of lofty, because there will always be disparities. So do you have any advice for small steps people can take to kind of get that started?
Get involved, right? That's probably what everyone's going to say. Mm-hmm. And just figure out think about a couple things you're passionate about, and do think about a couple, because you don't want to go down one road at this stage and just feel like doors get closed. And so think about a couple things you're passionate about, and then find local organizations on campus, lab research groups, whatever, that are working on that issue. And don't hesitate to cold call or cold email. Don't cold call maybe, but cold email people and just say, because I'm still bad at that at this stage in my career. I respond to pretty much 100% of those that I get or ask someone to, and sometimes we can't help, but sometimes we can pass you on to somebody else, or we know something going on. So I assume if you send out 10 or 12 emails, you'll probably get at least one or two helpful responses. And most of those, I think we all assume people won't respond. And in fact, most of the time they will. So that would be the first tiny step to take now. The other thing that many people who end up working with me or talking to me here is do think about what you want to do in health. I think there's a tendency, because we all think about it, to be I'm going to go to medical school if I want to work in health, right? But actually, we desperately need folks working in advocacy, folks working in policy, elected officials, folks with social work, folks in nursing, folks at all these different public health. Of course, I'm biased, but all these different fields all make an impact on health. And so you do not have to go to medical school. And in fact, you shouldn't go to medical school unless what you really want to do is that individual patient care. And for those people, medical school is 100% the right choice. And you can wrap some of those other things around it. But if you're I really want to make a difference at a policy level, then you might think twice about medical school and might think about going ahead and going for that, master's or PhD in policy. Because you can, believe it or not, pick up enough health knowledge, especially if you're thinking about systems-wide. You don't necessarily need that individual patient-level knowledge. And it's just a lot of time and energy and money. So again, absolutely the right choice for a lot of people, but I think sometimes it's the only choice we think of. And so just try to get people to think broadly about your grad school opportunities. Mm-hmm. For a fair number of people, too, you can go get the MPH or the MSW or the MPP and then still go to medical school if you think it's the right thing. I definitely have folks who've graduated from here who've done that and have taken that extra time. So just take little steps. Don't get frustrated. Like if it does, global health is really hard. Like, I mean, it can just be hard to find the right entry point. And you really, like, it's really important to do it ethically and to do it with a sort of anti-colonial perspective and thinking about power issues. And like, so sometimes like startup and finding the right group and stuff can be a lot trickier. Mm-hmm. So sort of patience and tenacity.
Yeah.
and trust your gut. Like if the group, if it doesn't feel right, it probably isn't. And so I would also say to be a little bit careful about, you know, thinking about what you get involved with and then it feels like a good thing. But those are kind of like a bunch of different steps from like just take little steps now to kind of start to. And I also do think, I mean, the inequities work is like, it's important here, it's important globally, like, and I do think you can do either one and at least think intelligently about the other, and it's just interesting to see where they fit together and where they don't. So I also don't think, like, yeah, I think it's okay to right. go back and forth, and or especially now for folks who are undergrads, like, to start in what is more the more clear pathway while, you know, looking for opportunities in the other if you're interested, or do a little bit of both.
Thanks so much for listening to our first episode of Health Around the World, and please stay tuned for our next episodes. This episode was produced by Joy Malloy, and for more podcasts by the Stanford Daily, please visit stanforddaily.com/category/podcast.